And first,
so Joe.
Okay. So if anyone's interested, I'm involved in the International Socialist Organization on campus, and we're having a kickoff tonight at 7:30 in Humanities. We're going to learn obviously more about what socialism is in the course of this class. And if you're interested in like building an alternative to capitalism or getting involved in activism on campus, then feel free to stop by and be talking about some of the stuff that we're getting involved with. So I will send these around if you're interested.
All right. Floor is open for questions on class, on the first broad set of issues we've been talking about. And as I said, in the spirit that everybody should always come prepared with some sort of question, I'll just randomly call on somebody if no one wants to start then. Joe.
It was interesting to me when you brought up the study in Britain that's going on right now, I haven't read the study or anything like that, but you mentioned that one of the classes they came up with was the traditional working class.
Right.
So I was interested in kind of knowing what that actually entailed. I was reading Harry Braverman's Labor and Monopoly Capital, and he was talking about sort of the differences between the old working class and the new working class in a lot of the ways that contemporary sociology talks about it, and kind of like sort of dispelling the myth of the new working class as being significantly different. He used one of the things that I remember from it is that he had mentioned like the emergence of engineers and janitors, and in the early like 1900s there were like 50,000 janitors and like 50,000 engineers, and today there are over 1 million janitors and there are also a significantly higher amount of engineers, but these two things are not, janitors are seen as like the old working class, whereas engineers would be seen as like a new educated working class, and so they both kind of emerged at the same time though. I'll just leave it at that, but I think it's interesting the way in which the working class is defined and redefined over time.
So in this particular study, they don't have a theoretical definition. It's just this empirically induced cluster, it's basically manual labor rather than intellectual labor. It's manual labor that's also relatively low educated, but has sufficient skill that their jobs are relatively stable. So those descriptions, this would involve going into the details of their study more than we need to here. The problem with the kind of study they do is they apply these labels because it somehow is capturing some sort of central feel to it, but because it's a purely inductively generated category, it has all sorts of weird people. People aren't weird. The classifications end up being pretty weird. That they're then just calling traditional working class because a lot of the occupations look like that. I mean, an example is if I remember correctly, the university professors are grouped with technical professionals rather than with, I forget what the, the technical middle class rather than the, let's see. Their categories were the established middle class, and there's the technical middle class, right? There's the elite, the established middle class, the technical middle class. And the technical middle class includes all sorts of very technological sort of middling positions. And then there's these highly educated professors who are in them. And it just has to do with because of the way the algorithm works. It's not because there's any conceptual unity. But when people use the expression traditional working class, they mean manual labor that doesn't have high levels of technical skill, sort of semi-skilled and unskilled manual labor. That's usually what's meant by it. And I think that's what this cluster has within it, but it has a lot of other stuff within it as well. Dimitra.
Your paper, you have to review. You give an example of this opportunity for me that if the United States open borders to everyone with a medical degree, computer science degree, the market will get over well with people with such credentials. This kind of undermines the additional value of this kind of degree, whatever. So citizenship rights are a special form of license which allows people to sell their labor in a particular labor market. But then the question arises, is all inequality dysfunctional? I mean, can we really open borders and allow all the migrants flow inside? So can we treat everyone equally? Like social psychologists claim that people constantly categorize and range people. Actually, we need to kind of treat people unequally to kind of handle kind of millions of people around us. So is it kind of what degree of inequality kind of is appropriate in it looks like everything we're talking about is about fighting inequality, but is it in every case functional? I mean?
Is what functional?
Trying to strive to maximum equality.
Maximum inequality or maximum
equality?
Well, first of all, I don't think that's a relevant question to the diagnosis of the mechanisms by which existing inequalities are preserved or intensified. That is, the diagnosis that opportunity hoarding through these various mechanisms is what reinforces the forms of inequality that are generated through markets. That diagnosis does not depend upon the claim that the optimal situation would be complete equality. And those are completely separate issues. The normative, so I'm not sure what the what the point of the question is relative to this discussion. There is a problem with respect to the forms of inequality that would emerge in the absence of opportunity hoarding, right? So the normative framework that I laid out at the very beginning in terms of my interpretation of an egalitarian value, which is all people should have equal access to the necessary material and social means necessary to live a flourishing life, that equal access principle. So the equal access principle does not mean that everybody ends up with exactly the same income, status, occupational, you know, position, and so on. It just means everybody has equal access to the material conditions to live a flourishing life. So there will be inequalities that would emerge. They just wouldn't violate the equal access principle, which means that if the equal access principle is in place, nobody can complain if their life doesn't go well, that it's because the society denies them access to the conditions to live a flourishing life. There may be all sorts of reasons why lives don't go well, but it can't be attributed to any structural mechanisms which block their access to the necessary resources or social conditions to flourish. Whatever inequalities exist then are innocent of that problem. Now, whether the inequalities which would continue, given the equal access position, would be optimal, or whether we have psychological needs to differentiate ourselves from others in terms of, you know, standing and status and all this, that's a completely separate set of issues. And I don't have a whole lot to say about it. I don't know what degrees of inequalities are somehow part of our hardwired nature as status animals. We are, it's certainly strong anthropological and psychological evidence that we are status-making animals. One among many kind of status-making species, where hierarchy seems to be pretty deeply ingrained. it doesn't mean that we can't overcome that. We're also carnivores, and many people live vegetarian lives. You know, so there's no inherent reason, just because of the hard wiring of our physiology due to evolution, that we can't make moral choices that lead us to live lives that are quite different from what our spontaneous, you know, biological equipment would lead us to do. So I don't know, I don't have an answer to the question. What levels of status differentiation and the like would seem to be the kind of healthy equilibrium for a society in which equal access has been provided.
Do you think it's right that the idea is to eliminate kind of artificial barriers which prevent people from kind of performing nicely, all these artificial inequalities?
Well, they're artificial in the sense of artifacts of society. They're not artificial in the sense of arbitrary. It's the socially generated inequalities of access to the conditions to flourish that are the indictment in the diagnosis and critique of society. So we can have a diagnosis and critique of human nature. We can have a diagnosis and critique of society. This is a diagnosis and critique of society, of its structures and mechanisms. And the critique is when they create these inequalities in access to the conditions to live a flourishing life. Yeah, Maddie.
I just kind of want to clarify. So the first like four questions that you would ask about class, those made sense and whatever. But the fifth and sixth, I didn't really understand. Were they aiming to be like, were they aiming to be ways of creating classifications, like creating a system of thinking about class, or were they just sort of questions that would help you, like, modify your view of class? I don't know.
Here's the thing. We have a question. What forms of conflict are most systematically linked to the social organization of production? That's a question. What forms are most systematically tied to the way our economy is organized? And one answer to that question is that class conflict is the form. And therefore, you would want to think about how to think about class conflict, how to define it, in a way that helps you understand conflict linked to organization of production. In that, the concept of class that helps you do that, that helps you explain conflict connected to production, is a concept within which the notion of interests, the interests of actors, gets systematically specified. And to systematically specify the concept of interests, that draws you towards things like exploitation. Because exploitation is a way of giving a systematic account of the way interests are generated in opposition to each other, rather than just interests that generated that are different from each other. So this is what we'll talk about next week. But when you think about the interests of actors, everybody has interests. You have, you know, if I asked you what are your economic interests, you'd be able to say something or other about it. Some of your economic interests are just generated by your preferences. You have interests in, you could say, I have interest in earning so much because I really like mountain biking in distant places and I have to earn enough money to do that. So I have interests in working a certain amount to earn the money. That would be a description of some interests that are derived from particular preferences you have. Other aspects of your interests are forged by the nature of the relations in which you live your life. And then it turns out that some of those are forged in opposition to other people's interests. Not just different from other people, but they're actually forged in opposition. Those are the kinds of interests that generate conflict. And that's what leads you to a concept of class relevant to answering this question. What forms of conflict are systematically linked to the organization of production? So just to retrace the steps, if you want to know what conflict is linked to production, you want to know how opposing interests are linked to production. If you want to decipher how opposing interests are linked to production, you're drawn into an analysis of how relations generate opposition, antagonism, rather than just roles. So one way of thinking about capitalists and workers are that these are just different roles in production. That's the kind of classic functional sociology that thinks about roles. Roles simply tell you what the requirements of the job are, what the norms that guide it are, what the expectations of people are, but doesn't say anything about how the roles harm or help each other, about the reciprocities and the tensions that are generated by virtue of the fact that roles are connected rather than just separate. And that's what this conflict question draws you towards. Okay? Yeah?
I just want to clarify, like, in a step six, the explanatory claims, you see what you have determines what you get. Like, here, what do you mean by what you have? I mean, as a range of different stuff, like, not just the material, but also, like, what's the education level of your parents, the geographic location of your hometown, something like that, like all kinds of different stuff, right? I mean, you mean what you have.
Well, there's many things that determine what you get besides things which you have control over, right? So the class analysis argument is about assets that you bring into economic activities. Your social background would fit in this analysis as explaining why you have what you have. Your education is something you bring with you to an economic interaction. So the way what you have determines what you get. You could replace that with your education determines your wages. And then you ask, how do you explain your education? And you could say, your family background and the city that you grew up in and the kinds of schools it had and your neighborhood, a whole set of social processes explain why you have the amount of education you have. But it's the amount of education that determines your wages. And so this first explanatory claim of class analysis, what you have determines what you get, could be about education. It could be about wealth. You know, the wealth you have determines your ability to earn income or to invest and get a return on your investment. So what you have determines what you get. If you're very wealthy, that enables you to invest your wealth and get a return on it. We can then also ask, how do you explain the wealth you have? And your background and your parents and your hometown would all help explain that. But you are not deploying your parents' background in your workplace. You're deploying your education. Now, there are some contexts in which you might be really deploying your parents' background. So if it's the case that your name gets you things, that is, you, one of the things you might have are connections. That's something that you bring with you, and or reputation, or fear that parents know that your prospective employers know that your parents are party bosses and that they should treat you well because otherwise they'll get in trouble. Well, that implies that there's a kind of status capital or political capital that you bring with you. It's a different kind of resource that you can bring with you. And it becomes an economic resource, a status resource. And if you really had a, if that was really a systematic part of a structure of inequality, then that would become an aspect of the class structure. Your connections to powerful people can become part of a class structure. Typically, in capitalist economies, those things are fairly peripheral. They're not irrelevant. They're not central, though. You know, they play a special role in special contexts, but it would not be a good description of how capitalist economies work to say that a really important resource that people bring into production that determines their fate is directly their family connections. It's a second order kind of.
So you say we could say some socioeconomic status play an important role in determining the class relations or in determining your a lot of aspects of your life, but I somehow feel like it's really hard to say a lot of stuff in a deterministic viewpoint. Like, okay, if you have a family like very high education, it definitely determines you will get a prosperous life. But in another way, if it's non-deterministic, then it's equally wrong. Like if you say, okay, the background of your, for instance, parents' education doesn't matter to your future. It's kind of equally wrong. So at what level, in the end, we could find a lot of correlations. Usually it's kind of correlations like we have the socioeconomic status correlated to the income level, for instance. And at what level we could get to a point and say, okay, socioeconomic status determines.
So the word determines here is a tricky one. When it's used without adjectives and these are sloganish statements, it gives the impression that this is deterministic in the sense that what you get is entirely determined by what you have. And these are probabilistic determinants here. We live in complex causal environments where there's a lot of random things that happen. So the full statement, what you have determines what you get, should be what you have significantly affects what you get or probabilistically determines what you get. Or determines what you get in conjunction with all sorts of random effects rather than uniquely determined. So this is the simplified form to just capture the nature of the relationship involved rather than the refined statement that fully specifies it. The way to think about it, what you have determines what you get. So there's a variety of things you have that you bring with you when you enter into a system of production. You bring your education, you bring your cultural capital, your style, your skills, your language ability, all these things. You bring wealth that gives you an ability to take risks. So what you have determines what you get can include family wealth that you bring with you insofar as it enables you to take, for example, an unpaid internship, which you would not be able to do if you didn't have family support. And the unpaid internship enables you to get a better job later on. So that's a way in which your wealth will determine what you get, even though you're not investing your wealth. It's just your family wealth gives you the insurance that enables you to do it. In all of those cases, determines just means significantly affects or probabilistically affects. It doesn't mean once you know what you have, you already know what you get. It's not, and that's in general, when I use the word determines, I'm not meaning completely determines. Yeah.
I have a question kind of on a different note. So in the class analysis of poverty article, you talk about shoes and you use the comic to kind of illustrate that. And what we were kind of talking about in our study group earlier today was kind of bad jobs. So if everyone gets schmooze, then they have greater choice over what jobs they take because they're not as likely to get exploited because they have what they need to basically survive. And so I guess my question is, what happens to these jobs that no one really wants to do but people feel like they have to do because they have to survive and that's what they get? And do wages just increase, or do they cease to exist, these jobs? And also, kind of the overqualification problem that we're facing today, where there's a lot of college grads and whatnot that can't find work, that's, you know, that they are envisioning. Right. So I guess, you know, if Schmooze kind of accelerates that problem and kind of makes a lot more people who are qualified because they have more, you know, ability to pursue those things, you know, what do the jobs look like and what happens to the jobs that no one wants to do?
Okay. We'll also talk about the Schmooze on Tuesday, because that's when we talk about exploitation, where that is a way of clarifying the idea of exploitation. So let me answer the question in two ways. First, the Schmooze are a special story because the key idea in the Schmooze is it's manna from heaven, right? It comes from outside the system. There's a Schmooze-like idea. It's not a real Schmooze because it's not exogenous, which is basic income. So we can imagine an economy in which everybody is guaranteed, as a matter of rights, and unconditionally, a basic income sufficient to live at a minimal but decent standard of living. Let's call it the no-frills above poverty line standard of living. You know, so it enables you to go to the movies, you know, a few times a month, but not every night, right? So it gives you an entertainment budget. So that's part of what a decent but minimal standard of living has, an entertainment budget. But you can't go to the Met in New York every time you want to. You have to ration your Met. Okay. So if everybody had a basic income, first of all, lots of people would still want discretionary income. They'd want income above that. But it's discretionary because they don't have to do it in order to live at this basic decent. So that's it accomplishes what the Schmoo idea accomplishes. So what happens to the employment structure? Lousy jobs that people really don't want to do have a number of possible dynamic fates to them. One is that the wage rates would go up. You just have to bribe people more. So basically that pay has to reflect the unpleasantness of work rather than the scarcity of jobs. You just pay bad, unpleasant labor a lot. Another possibility is that a lot of those bad jobs aren't really needed anyway. They only exist because there's a labor pool available to do it for little. So if an example of a bad job is, cleaning people's houses at low wages, so people's houses are a little messier, unless they want to pay more for it. But another possibility is that people will be willing to do those bad jobs in small doses because they'll get discretionary work. And the $7 an hour that's currently paid for a low-wage job, if you're going to do it for 10 hours a week to get $70 of discretionary income, it's not such a burden. It's a crappy job, but it's only 10 hours a week because you only need to do it to get the discretionary part of your income, not to get your basic income. And there may be lots of people who are going to want to live their lives by working $10 a week in a crappy job for not very much money because that's the amount of discretionary income they want. It's even possible that, if you really had a basic income, there'd be no reason to have a minimum wage laws anymore, really, you know. If I have my basic needs met and I'm prepared to work for $3 an hour for some job that I find interesting or not or whatever, what's the objection? The moral objection to low wages is because of the power differentials that force people to take those low jobs. So you would end up with, I think, probably for a lot of crappy jobs, a lot of people willing to do it for very limited number of hours a week, because that's the amount of discretionary income they want. If the jobs are important and there isn't enough people who want to do it for a few hours a week, then the wages have to go up on them. Yeah?
So do you think that there's the only kind of incentive for people to do these jobs is just because they want this more discretionary income and that's their goal? They don't want to achieve higher than that now that they have their base?
Well, I'm saying that would be the incentive to take really crappy jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not the only incentive for people to work.
Yeah.
People want to work because of sociability, because of the interest and creativity of the jobs, because it's part of a life, you know, that you live your life in community with people in your workplace, and it's part of career. I mean, there's all sorts of reasons why people want to work. In a world with basic income or with schmooze, the possibility of self-organized work goes way up. So a lot of the overeducated, marginally employed people, if their basic income was present, that was secure, would be able to engage in cooperative activities, which could generate income. Some of it would, some of it wouldn't. But they could engage, it'd be much easier for them to form co-ops around various collective projects, because the co-op wouldn't have to also generate their basic income, their shmoo, as it were. That's most obvious in the arts. You know, that's the kind of obvious place where this would happen. The problem of in theater and dance and music is that people that really want to devote their life to it have to also generate their income from the activity, and that's very, very tough to do. So if the basic income or the shmoo provided your, you know, your basic salary, then the formation of theater troupes in which actors and directors would form cooperatives, the only problem they would really face would be infrastructure. They need places to perform, but they wouldn't need to generate their basic income. Yeah.
So our discussion group, going back to schmooze again, was talking about the rank ordering of preferences for the fate of the schmoo that you have. So I think we were all kind of just wondering, like, well, are we sure that the working class wouldn't just decide, well, like, only we should have schmooze? How come everybody should have schmooze? So just, could you just talk about that a little bit?
So remember, the criteria is that they simply want to do what's best for themselves. So are workers better off in a world where capitalists do not have schmooze, but they do? Or in a world with where capitalists also have schmooze? What advantage is it for workers to have capitalists be a little bit poorer? There aren't any. That is basically, as long as workers, they're either indifferent, they don't care, it's no skin off my nose, let the capitalists have a schmoo, or it's slightly better if you're going to look for work because you want some discretionary income for your employer to have a little bit more resources. You'd rather work for an employer that has more money rather than less money. There's more room to maneuver. There's more bargaining. There's the capitalists out of their profits don't have to pay for their oatmeal, just their caviar. And so there's a little bit more left over for wage bargaining. So all things considered, workers are either indifferent or marginally better off if everybody has a schmoo than if only they have schmooze. Yeah?
So something that we sort of talked about a bit, and I suspect we'll get into this more, is that, like, in the case that there are universal schmooze and people still engage in menial labor for discretionary income, is that still considered an exploitative relationship?
Well, it's a really interesting question, whether it's exploitative. Is capitalism between consenting adults, when it's true consent, that is, you have a full exit option, is it exploitative? Well, in a technical sense, you are performing labor at a wage rate which is profitable to your employer. The employer is still paying you something from which the employer ends up with a profit. Otherwise, the employer wouldn't bother. So whatever wage rate you end up agreeing with, it must be the case that some surplus is being produced above and beyond what you're being paid, that the employer is appropriating. Otherwise, the employer wouldn't hire you, right? So on that just general premise that employers only employ people when they get something out of it, the employer is making a profit off of your labor, and that is a form of exploitation. So there is exploitation going on, but is it exploitation that generates an antagonism of interests? And is it an exploitation that triggers moral concern? Well, in the schmoo story, since the level of living that the schmoo provides is this no-frills basic standard of living, one might still argue that the remaining inequalities generate unequal access to the material conditions to live a flourishing life. That is, the shmoo worker who has to work in a crappy job for discretionary income has to work harder to get the necessary material means to live a flourishing life than does the capitalist. And so there is an inequality which is still condemnable, and the inequality plays itself out through this low-intensity exploitation of discretionary income, which doesn't have as harsh a bite to it, but which still reflects some background inequalities, so that if instead of the capitalist, the worker who's working in this crappy job for discretionary income was working for a worker co-op that was doing the same work, then the worker providing that work would also get a piece of the surplus that's being generated. And therefore one would say, yes, I think it's still exploitation, but it's exploitation that is way less of concern than exploitation in which the exit options are way so much curtailed. Yeah.
So if the system of capitalism is still functioning within a society that offers universal schmooze, then capitalism still necessarily has to accumulate capital, like, continuously, right? And so, like, what happens when capitalists come into competition with one another, and does that sort of, is that in the end going to undermine the basic income or the shmoo that, like, people end up getting and just sort of revert back to capitalism full-blown?
Right, so the shmoo story has the advantage that it wouldn't undermine the shmoo because the shmoo is manna from heaven. It's outside the system. It's not generated inside the system. So capitalists can do whatever they want. You still get your shmoo. Basic income is more problematic because basic income is generated out of the surplus that's produced in capitalism. So in a capitalist system, to have an unconditional basic income, what you basically have is a system that has to generate enough income so that you can redistribute the surplus in such a way as to guarantee everyone a basic income and still have surplus available for capitalists to invest, because capitalists remain the source of jobs, or of at least a source of jobs in the economy. That's a much more complicated dynamic equation in terms of how it evolves over time. One view is that no, a capitalism with a generous enough basic income to have these virtues would not be sustainable, would be self-destructive. So that if you want a basic income, you have to have some kind of socialism. You can have social ownership plus basic income, or capitalism without a basic income, but you can't have capitalism with a basic income. That's one view. Another view is, no, in an advanced in a world of advanced technologies where adequate standards of living can be produced very efficiently for most people, you can have a capitalist sector that continues to function in an ordinary capitalist way, and a universal basic income, which then underwrites a cooperative market sector that operates in tandem with capitalism, in which there's interactions between the two, and it'll be a kind of incomplete transformation that can still have a stable enough equilibrium to be reproduced over time. And there are these differing views on the matter. I don't think there's any way on purely theoretical grounds to resolve it. You know, it's just too dependent on the strategies of actors and on what their best options are and on what kind of compromises within the state allow to set in place constraints. It's too contingent on that. And the simple view is that you can't have that in capitalism because capitalists are too powerful and they simply won't allow it. I think that's just too pat an answer. I think it's a reasonable, I don't think that's an unreasonable first guess. You know, I'm not optimistic that you could have a stable equilibrium of that kind of a more egalitarian form. But for 50 years, we had Northern European social democracy with historically unprecedented levels of equality. and low risk for ordinary people, and which was extremely stable, and produced a very vibrant capitalism in those areas. So we know that it's possible to combine capitalist and various non-capitalist forms in a sufficiently complementary way that it works. And I don't see any inherent reason why that was only possible in that short window, you know, after the Second World War, and it's no longer a possibility. I need to get to New York. Thank you.